This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we take you to an encampment of emergency responders as they imagine all hell breaking loose. And we have breakfast with a group of runners who are attempting to unify the Americas in peace and dignity by running from Alaska to Panama. So now, let's go inside the Compass.
Search and rescue.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hey, Milo.
And what can
just
you tell me about the road?
I'm hollering and no one as far as you.
Okay.
At least two dozen people wearing brightly colored vests with bold labels saying things like logistics, public health, or EOC supervisor were already gathered around a set of plastic-topped folding tables under a pair of bright red easy-up canopies, all hung about with whiteboards, installed on the Little League softball field across from the sheriff's office in Port Hadlock when I got there about 40 minutes after the 8 a.m. Nixle alert message last Tuesday that heralded the commencement of the massive worst-case earthquake drill known as Cascadia Rising, an emergency management exercise that would involve agencies both military and civilian at every level of government throughout Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and British Columbia for the next 4 days. The scenario that would unfold over that time involved a hypothetical earthquake measuring 9.0 on the Richter scale in the Cascadia subduction zone, followed by not one but a series of tsunamis. Taken together, the disasters would cause many thousands of casualties and cause serious damage to infrastructure like highways, bridges, railways, water delivery systems, sewers, and communication lines throughout the Puget Sound region and beyond. Many thousands of buildings would also be destroyed, including pretty much all of Port Townsend's downtown area, along with, for the sake of the practice, Jefferson County's own state-of-the-art Emergency Operations Center, or EOC. Which is why, for the first day of the drill, the alternate field EOC had been set up in the field across the street, with the red-topped easy-up serving as situation room and operations center, surrounded by communications trailers and a well-appointed RV that served as the incident commander's headquarters. When I arrived, almost everyone was deeply engaged in the collection and exchange of information, trying to get a grasp on the dimensions of the supposed catastrophe. But I noticed one man, wearing a vest that identified him as logistics, who seemed surprisingly idle.
Maybe you could explain your function here for me.
Because I'm the only guy standing around doing nothing, right?
Well, I see you're logistics, and it looks like there's not a lot of logistics going on at the moment. Is that right?
Usually the initial part of any operation, there's very little work for logistics to do, right? But usually as the incident progresses, logistics gets busier and busier because we take care of all what we call resources. We acquire resources, right? Which means human materials, supports, right? So what logistics does is they take care of making sure that everything that these guys over here in ops want, that we get them what they need. Right? So you come back and look at me about 2 o'clock this afternoon. Right? Then the other part of what we do is we take care of the facilities that the operations plannings and all the other units work in. Right? So if it's a remote location like this, we make sure we have food, water, hydration, right, sanitation. Basically, we make sure that all of the things that they need so that they can do their jobs is available to them. Right? And we take care of the safety. Make sure the site's correct, identify any hazards, mitigate those hazards if possible. And then he takes care of general facilities needs, electricity, water, power.
Well, now, I noticed that a lot of logistics has been done here already. It's kind of remarkable considering that the event was at 8 o'clock this morning, and now this whole thing is set up. There's antennas out here. So how long did that actually take?
The way we are set up right now takes approximately 12 man hours to do. So if you're doing it by yourself, it's going to take you 12 hours. If you have a 20-man team, you're going to do it in under an hour. Everything you see here, so all the tables, chairs, tents, all of this is maintained in that trailer, right?
Okay.
It's a portable operation center. We can take it out to West County or any place we need to go with it if we have to work in any kind of remote site. We have every tool we need to be able to function effectively.
A little while later, I noticed a woman whose vest identified her as Mass Care.
So, excuse me, what is your name?
Tanda McMillan.
And I see that you are Mass Care. ESF, what does that mean?
ESF exactly? 6. Mass Care, mostly it means sheltering. It means food, water. We're going to try to keep the food sources coming. So we're trying to assess who's without critical goods and who needs sheltering. And working with public health on avoiding public health issues.
And what is the situation right now in terms of, like, food?
It's a stark thing to say, but we are almost an area where we have no resources. We have no warehousing capability for food and resources. So we have done an aggressive plan to try to get individuals to take responsibility and have food in their homes, a food so they can self-sustain themselves and their neighbors. So we're really putting a big push on individual responsibility and neighborhood responsibility to take care of each other. If we put in a request from our location here to the state, which we will probably do tomorrow, because we will know that we need food, it will still take weeks to get here.
What is the situation with the roads right now, according to the scenario?
Right now, I don't know specifically, but I did know that most major roads are to be are damaged, impassable. Most bridges are. All culverts are. Haven't heard about the Hood Canal, but if we're playing in real time, the Hood Canal Bridge got hit a few minutes ago by the first tsunami. So we have limited capabilities for roads and also for perhaps our ferry docks, and which we would like to be able to get the resources in here by water, but perhaps our ferry docks are gone as well. So we'll be hearing, have not heard yet if we've got any eyewitness on the ferry dock here. So we're going to assume that the water transport is not going to be available to us, at least not right now, or in the near future.
At a small remove from the rest of the action, I noticed a trailer staffed by several men in camouflage who were standing under an awning and messing with some electronic gear. I went over to see who they were.
Hi, Steve Evans from KPTZ.
Greg Green, Nevada National Guard.
Really? Wow, you just heard about this emergency this morning at 8 o'clock and you got out here that quickly?
No. We were given a warning order to come out. So
what's your function with this exercise?
All the comm capability that we provide. We're set up to use our satellite link, reach back. So in the event that everything here is wiped out or does not work or is being overwhelmed by people trying to call on the cell towers, then we have a complete separate connection that provides all those services. So
presumably if this were a real emergency and it were happening at random at some point, how long would it take you to be here, you think?
Well, every state has this, so that's the first kind of thing there, but this can be airlifted on a C-130 to anywhere in the country to meet minimum time frame. So basically, when we hit the ground, our time is to be set up and running operational with the internet within an hour. So add on top of that any of the travel time it takes us to get there. And that's our response time.
It was clear that a lot of thought had gone into communications. There was a separate trailer with about a handful of ham radio operators working to establish links with their peers in other locations. I spoke briefly with Rod Mash about their role in the exercise.
So what's the function of the ham radio operators in this exercise?
When the power goes out, you're out of luck for a while. The cell phone goes out, normal communications goes out. So it's a way of backing up, even from some of the remote islands has a digital signal we're trying to send. And so it's a hobby, but we also feel we can do a lot of good and have done.
Emergency operation centers like Jefferson County's pretty much universally operate under a protocol known as the Incident Command System. Within the system, each participant has a carefully defined role. At the top of the pyramid is the incident commander, who in this case was Jefferson County's Emergency Management Director Bob Hamlin, a wiry, energetic man with close-cropped white hair who has made a livelihood from contemplating disaster since 1969 and who has served in his position since 1999. I had been warned not to bother Hamlin during the exercise, so I was somewhat surprised when he invited me into his command headquarters RV to view a video simulation on a map graphic of the tsunamis that were at that moment supposedly smashing the Puget Sound. As he loaded the video, I asked him a question about the mechanics of the exercise.
Let me just ask you a question about the drill here. So,
yes, sir.
Who is actually, you know, calling in the incidents?
There's a simulation cell up at the fire station in Port Townsend, and they're the acting as the real world.
So they're the ones who are actually deciding that 101 is out or
they,
the hood
well,
canal's
we
been destroyed.
We decided that, I mean, a long time ago.
Oh,
they're
I
the
see.
Ones who are communicating that information.
I see. So they're not really throwing curveballs at
you. Oh, no, they're not allowed to do that. No, they have. It's got to be ground truth. So it's what would actually occur in this scenario. This is what we're playing. So
I see.
So here's the model. Tsunamigenic invent. We want you to switch your eye when you get to there. Now there's the clock down there. So there's the first arrival coming into Squim Bay, and now it's in Discovery Bay. Look at that purple.
Right. Yeah.
And then it's in Port Townsend Bay. Now it's down at the bridge. You're at 3.5 hours, and it goes all the way to Tacoma.
Are they expecting that this will take the bridge out? If
it's going to be this, all of this is going to be full of debris.
Oh, right.
So, yeah. So watch it when it gets a little bit more detail. It hits two or three times in Discovery Bay.
Okay.
So there's one. Okay, there's the purple. That's one, two, and then there, and then another one in there, and then another one, and then it comes back in there. And then it hits the bridge. Now, when it gets to the bridge, it's about 3 meters. So it's doing this, what's known as a seiche. It's a bathtub effect.
Right, it's sloshing around.
Yeah, sloshing around.
In a great
so
big bathtub.
The idea that it's not going to turn the corner is not a really well-founded idea. It is going to turn the corner.
It's really hard to see in this detail also what happens to downtown, but I imagine it's not pretty.
Well, downtown, we've pretty well figured out. Everything up to the base of the bluffs is all liquefaction, and it's all inundation zone. The models show that's a significant impact down there. So, yeah, the downtown's already on the model.
So now this exercise is happening all over the Puget Sound and the state, even the state EOC is participating in
Washington, Oregon, Idaho, British Columbia. There are 30,000 people involved in this exercise at the National Guard level, at the military level, at the state level in the three states. It's the largest single non-disaster response ever.
Hey, good day. We're going to do that 5-minute drill in 2 minutes from now, so get ready. Thank you.
In late morning, about an hour after the supposed tsunamis had hit, a so-called 5-minute drill was held, a regular reporting practice in which all of the key players at the EOC gather to swap notes about what they are learning and what they need.
Stop all phone traffic if you can. We're going to go through in order, law, fire, public health, Julia, okay, mass care, Tanda, and then Don or Matt for utilities, public work, maybe. Cover these topics, please. You prepared it. Current activities, major activities, your highest priorities for the next operational period, your unmet needs, unique crisis points, your issues needing coordination with others. And we'll start with law.
I guess I'll go.
Basically, you'd have 2 to 4. We would have had 2 officers on when the earthquake hits at 8. You know, some would have showed up, so we could say we'd have 2, 4, 5 somewhere in there. We don't have any heavy equipment or anything. Guns aren't doing us any good right now. So what we're going to do is work closely with fire, and what I would instruct my people to do is go out and calm the public, be a uniform presence, try and get together work group of citizens, make them self-reliant, leave that area, go to the next area, and just work your way from worst the priority areas, see if you can get some citizens working. The worst thing we could have is idle citizens, panicking citizens. Just by being out there, being a calming presence, telling people, yeah, even though it's pure chaos, we do have a plan, we're working on it, and really put able-bodied citizens to work.
That's good. Public health.
Yes, here. We have, obviously, there's many fatalities and injuries. And I have no status report on any of the healthcare system. I have not heard from Jefferson Healthcare. So I've put in a request to logistics for 2,000 body bags and a temporary morgue. I have not heard back from them. I've also requested from the National Disaster Medical System a medical supply facility or a medical treatment facility plus transportation of injuries. And I haven't heard back from that request. And so obviously unmet need is where to put the bodies that are dead and where to send the people who need medical care at this moment. So,
good questions. Mass care.
Mass care. We're monitoring critical shortages, and as of right now, we're seeing some persons without food and in need of some comfort here in Operational Area 1 and only Operational Area 1. So I'm looking for and trying to hear anything that's happening in any of the other operational areas. We know that we have only displaced persons, again, in operational area, and we have less than 300. So at this point in time, we're not seeing enough reports to do anything related to sheltering at this time. So we're looking for any kind of critical information you're hearing on displaced persons. Notifications, we put out several notifications this morning, both to the neighborhoods to activate their plans, shelter in place if it's safe to do so. Coordinated with public health on notification to boil water, and we put out a no flush order.
Thank you.
And all of that notification I'm doing through the ham operators because we don't yet have any other of our systems up and going that's available to me. That's it.
We're going to do utilities, we're going to do PUD, and then we'll do public works. But Don.
Okay, our current major activities and highest priorities are basically the same, getting the backbone transmission systems up and running and get those repaired. And then some secondary clearing and assessment of the distribution system. The next highest met priority and some would be the inflow of contractors and materials and portable substations to serve the area here.
In case you just tuned in, this is coverage of last week's Cascadia Rising drill. There has not been an actual emergency. Here was Incident Commander Bob Hamlin's report.
We have more problems than we have solutions. That's not going to fix itself today. But we need to let go of some of the lighter stuff. The standard of care has changed. That means we don't use resources where it's not economical. Don't use resources on single problems when you have multiple problems. So the standard way of triaging just doesn't work. My highest priority for the next operational period is to get more vertical communications. I'm not communicating very well with anybody at above this location just because of comms problems. I'm going to fix those. And that's my primary unmet need is ability to get some policy guidance. The declaration of emergency is going to happen probably both in the county and the city. It's not absolutely essential, but it'll be something I want to happen really soon. And in terms of coordination, setup here was a little bit of stilted to begin with, and that was just because of the artificiality of it. You're starting to work together now. I would like to see more communication between plans and operations, and if we could maybe change, take a couple of seconds to change configuration, I think that'll help you a little bit. So coordinate more. Internally coordinate with yourselves. I'm missing some information, but that's because I haven't been looking. And I'm now starting to start slowly catching up. And that's me.
The final report came from Fireman Sam Neville.
Our current situation is that pretty much all of Washington and Washington streets have been completely devastated. I've got multiple major structures in active fire right now. The highest priority right now is collecting casualties and cleaning up or finishing up our windshield survey to find out what is damaged, what is opened, and what we have left. My biggest need right now is resources. We're extremely limited on resources and our abilities to do that. So currently we're creating casualty collection points, trying to anticipate our next work group needs for transportation, and I should have local medical units established in certain regions by about mid-afternoon or so. We've asked the ham operators and the PIO to reach out to the community groups to report in their current conditions, and we're essentially in an information gathering point at this point.
Having noticed that much of the earliest work after such a disaster would call for rescue services, I took the opportunity to ask Neville how many firemen were actually on duty that morning.
So if this event were to happen, happen at 8 o'clock in the morning, 12 within District 1, 7 in District 3, 2 to 4 in Districts 2 or 4, depending. And then you've got your callbacks from your volunteers, and I'm not familiar with just how many resources Area 2, 4, and 5 will be able to provide. So we're pretty limited in what resources we do have initially. Well, some people are going to be incapacitated. Some people won't be able to get here because of the bridge or managing their own emergencies at home. So we have to take that into play.
A recurrent theme of the drill throughout the first day was the difficulty in obtaining a clear picture of the extent of the damage or the needs of the citizenry. Backup satellite communication systems for the EOC don't necessarily provide any kind of picture of the actual situation on the ground. Neighborhood ham or family service radio operators might be more helpful, but the picture that really emerged was clear. When the big one comes, it might be a very long time before help comes from outside. So the better prepared individuals in neighborhoods are, the better off they'll be. This is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News. With this song, Doug and Mancy Milholland and several other residents and friends of the Rosewind co-housing community welcomed about a dozen very long-distance runners to a hearty breakfast of polenta, veggie scrambled eggs, muffins, and homegrown strawberries at the Rosewind Common House last Friday, before sending them on their way for the next 54-mile leg of their long journey from Alaska to Panama. The runners were part of the Peace and Dignity Journeys, an event that has recurred every 4 years since 1992, which was the 500th anniversary of Columbus's arrival in the New World. Subtitled Reuniting the Eagle and the Condor, the long-distance relay run originated in response to a prophecy common to many indigenous peoples throughout the Americas that goes something like, "When the eagle and the condor fly together once again, the earth will awaken. The eagles of the north cannot be free without the condors of the south." As I stood in the breakfast buffet line, I talked about the run with a young Navajo runner named Donnie.
Good morning.
Good morning. So where did you join the run?
In Alaska. I started in Alaska.
So you started at the... So you're all, like, doing the whole...
Well, there was about 12 of us that met up in Alaska on about the 29th of April. And then we started running on May 1st out of Sutton, Alaska. And then we actually split runners in Watson Lake in the Yukon. And they took 8 runners on a different route that's going down the middle of the United States through the Dakotas down into Texas. And we're meeting up with them in Mexico. And we took 4 core runners from Alaska. And then around the 19th of May, is 4 more runners showed up in Dease Lake. And then so... There's about 8 or 9 of us that are going the whole way, and then about 3 or 4 people that's been helping out along the way, too.
So are you all from different tribal nations?
Yeah, we're from all over the place. There's some of us from California, from Mexico, from up in Canada, from all over the place.
In the greeting circle that preceded the meal, a large woman with full-length skirts and a commanding presence briefly explained that the Peace and Dignity Journeys are more spiritual than athletic.
Prayer run, a ceremonial run, and we're praying. It's always peace and dignity. We always pray for peace and dignity, but we have underlying prayers, and we're praying for the seed this year. Yeah, because of things that are happening to our seeds, and two, you know, we talk about our children, our seeds, and then two, someone was talking the other night about our words, our seeds too, and our children, and other things, other prayers come along the road. We have probably about 55 prayer staffs that are with us, that we run with and pray with, and people put feathers on them, or there's different things that are on them that have different prayers. We have prayers for the youth and for the elders. We have prayers for survivors of suicide. We have, you know, alcohol sobriety, well-briety, all those things.
What did you say first? Do you have something that you put them on?
We have a prayer, we have staff, so it looks like a piece of wood, but someone's prayed with it and has brought it back, you know, made it into a staff, a prayer staff.
I soon learned that the speaker was Annabelle Gutierrez, who gave herself the title of run coordinator, but whom others simply referred to as the boss. I asked her about the origins and the mechanics of the run.
This run has been going on since 1992. It's in the early 90s in Quito, Ecuador, indigenous nations came together and started talking about land rights, water rights, and all those things that affected us, and realizing that they affected you whether you were in South America or you were in Alaska. And at the time, the elders were talking about unification of the eagle and the condor and talking about how we could do that. And some people from Chicago came and they said that they had had a dream about running to unite the continent. But when they went and talked to the elders said, oh, we've been waiting for you, because it's an actual prophecy of the eagle and the condor. They call it the Quinto Sol, or the fifth sun. And two, you know,
whose prophecy is this?
It's a Mayan prophecy. And actually, it's not just a Mayan prophecy. I have to say that, because I hear, no matter where we've traveled, we heard it within the Yaquis. There's a friend of ours who's Mojave, and he said that when he was little, his grandpa would tell him, there will come a time when there's a bow that reaches from the tip of Alaska to the tip of South America, and there'll be arrows that'll be shot from it. And he was little, and he'd be like, that's not ever going to happen. And then when we were circled up for the first time in Teotihuacan, the way that they put the staffs is that they put them in the shape of an arrow, and the runners were the bow. And that's when he realized that's what it was about, the unification.
How was it organized? I mean, what were sort of the links of communications among the tribes?
I guess it was just talking as we were going through, saying, we're going to be in Mexico City. This is where we're going to be at. We need you to come. Just kind of like we've been doing coming down the road, we're going to go to Panama this year. And so we've been asking elders, come to Panama on November 14th. Be part of our four-day ceremony as we're closing everything up. So kind of by word of mouth.
I see. So are you personally running in this?
No, I'm the coordinator, and I take care of all the logistics. I drive a vehicle. I make sure the runners are safe. So that's my job. And when we run, we do here in this territory, we do a kind of like a relay where I drop, if I have 10 runners, I could have 10 runners on the road at one time. So I drop them off every mile. And then we have another van that comes and picks them up.
Oh, so the runners are each sort of running separately from one another. It's not a group of 10 runners all together.
Not in this territory. In Alaska, they run like that. They group run in Alaska because that's how the chief in Alaska requests that we run it.
Most of the runners were young and fit-looking, but one man stood out for his gray hair. I went to talk with him and learned that at 68, Jose Cortez was by far the eldest runner. A former labor organizer and radio talk show host, this was his second Peace and Dignity journey, and although he had twisted his ankle on the first day and couldn't really run well, he was determined to push through all the way to Panama. I asked him what the run meant to him.
The first time I did it was 4 years ago, and that's when I was running with Anabel's father. He had an accident in the Grand Canyon, and he passed away as a result of that accident. So I decided that I would do this run in his honor. So that's the reason why I'm doing this run in his honor. Plus, I also know that it's going to help me reach another level of spirituality, which is what I've been trying to do since I retired. Most people do all the hard things before they retire. I do all the hard things after I retired. So, you know, here I am.
Quite the philosopher, Cortez at one point in our conversation pointed out that the runners were linking all the communities they passed through into a single large community.
We're doing our job, but we're not doing it alone. You're helping us. Every community that we go through puts in their little piece of the puzzle.
Breakfast was followed by a ceremony, which I was asked not to record, in which all of the blanket-wrapped prayer staff bundles were carefully laid out on the lawn in an east-west orientation, and then, after a ritual cleansing in the fragrant smoke of a sage smudge, each of the runners carefully selected a staff to carry in prayer that day. The remaining prayer staffs were then tenderly rewrapped and tied and ceremoniously carried back to the three large vans that accompany the runners and carry all of their gear. Then, after farewell hugs befitting old friends, all of the runners save Cortez clambered aboard one of the vans to be dropped off at intervals along Discovery Road.
Following the vans, Cortez hobbled out towards Discovery Road and Friday night's destination on the Lower Elwha. This is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Mondays and Saturdays at noon, Tuesdays at 5 p.m., and Wednesdays at 10 a.m., exclusively here on KPTZ, the home of eclectic, authentic community radio. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.